Hi, everybody. This is Nick Fletcher, and this is the pre-EPOSNA edition of Interview of the PD Pod. Today, my guest is Corinna Franklin. Corinna is a current POSNA board member, the chief of pediatric orthopedics at Yale University, and also the president of the Ruth Jackson Orthopedic Society, and serves as a mentor for many young women, both in orthopedics, but also who have an interest in going into it. She has a tremendous pedigree, as you'll hear. She is really a world traveler, having grown up in Rome before coming back to the States. She did sort of high school in New York and college at Harvard, as well as medical school there before doing residency at USC in California, and then coming back to do her fellowship at CHOP. She was at the Shriners Hospital in Philadelphia for 10 years, really building a sports program at that time before moving over to Yale, where she has helped to build and grow a really strong program in pediatric orthopedics. Corinna has so many outside interests and is really just a fascinating person to talk to. I know that you will have a good time listening to this. Her interests in sports medicine focus in many ways on sort of differences in sexes and how women athletes and men athletes differ. And so we get into a little bit of some of this stuff. But she really is a tremendous guest and very fun to talk to. And I know that you'll enjoy this wide-ranging conversation with Corinna Franklin. I look forward to seeing so many of you at EPOSNA in a couple of weeks. I think it's going to be a terrific meeting. And the group, from a leadership standpoint, with David Farrington and Tony Riccio, have done a terrific job putting together a very diverse program. So enjoy this conversation with Corinna Franklin, and we'll see you in a few weeks. So, Corinna, thank you so much for being here today. I'm going to sort of welcome you into the podcast. This is a real treat for me. You've been somebody who I've had sort of on my list of people to talk to for a while, so I appreciate you making the time.
Thanks so much, Nick. It's a real pleasure to be here and speak with you today.
So I was like a little bit of a Genesis story, and so I would love to know what you were like as a kid. If I remember correctly, you were a Northeast girl and grew up in the Northeast, but I may be wrong there. Tell me a little bit about what you were like as a kid and where you grew up and that kind of thing.
Sure. I actually grew up all over the place. I was born in Minnesota in St. Cloud, which is right in the middle of the state, but I went to kindergarten in Rome in Italy to a Catholic school called Dottrina Cristiana. And then I went to Montessori school in Minnesota after that, and then sixth grade and public school in North Carolina, in Durham. And then I went to high school in New York. So I went to Brearley, which is an all-girls high school in New York. And then after that, I went to Harvard for college and med school, then USC for residency, and then CHOP for fellowship. So kind of all over the place. The only place I've never really lived is the Pacific Northwest, I would say.
Wow, that's pretty cool. My mom actually went to Brearley.
Oh, really?
Yep, she went to Burley, and back in the, what would that be, 50s and 60s, and went to your rival. Yeah. She was a Brown, so.
Cool.
Yeah, you're the only other person I've ever met who went to Burley. So that's
Really?
Cool. Yeah.
That's funny. There is another, there's at least one other orthopedic surgeon who went to Burley who was in my sister's class as well.
That's cool. Now, why'd you bounce around so much?
Not military, which is usually the first assumption, but my parents are both academics.
Okay.
And so we would go different places kind of for their, either they would get fellowships or for their research. So we went to Rome because my mom was a fellow at the American Academy in Rome, which is actually kind of an incredible place for a variety of reasons. It's sort of like a humanities think tank. So basically they give fellowships from ranging from 6 months to 2 years to artists and scholars of all different types. So there might be musicians, art historians. My mom's a medievalist. And they live and work there for the period of their fellowship. It's really cool. It's a beautiful location. It's up on the Janiculum in Rome. And my mom actually, much later when I was a resident, she was the director. So when I, so to speak, went home from LA, it was to Rome, which was really great.
Yeah. That is so cool. So, and is she, she's not there now?
No, she's a professor at Columbia.
Unbelievable. And your dad was able to sort of work through something similar?
Yeah. At that time, my dad was a professor as well. And he, you know, he has a huge interest in church history. And so often he would have work to do in similar locations. Although when we went to North Carolina, he was a visiting scholar at Duke and she was at the National Endowment for the Humanities. My dad is actually now a bishop.
Wow.
Yeah, so they lived semi-separately for a while because he was the bishop of Western New York. So his diocesan seat was in Buffalo, whereas my mom was still a professor in New York at Columbia, and they would travel back and forth. But now he is retired from the full-time bishop, and he is an assisting bishop on Long Island. So he and my mom lived together in New York.
That is amazing. So it's sort of funny. My wife's family, my father-in-law is an artist and my mother-in-law is a writer. And it's interesting, like, I mean, my wife had never had any sort of inclination towards anything medical, but I'm sort of curious how you came up in a family where, like, typically religion and medievalists aren't going to raise this, you know, superstar academic surgeon. How in the world did that happen? Like, what were you like as a kid? Was this something that happened at an early age or that came about later?
I guess I would say up till about high school, I was a pretty studious kid. Yeah, I read a lot of books. I mean, like all kids who grew up in Minnesota, I was sort of outdoorsy. I was a pretty serious runner from a pretty early age. So from junior high, I was a distance runner and I ran and at Brearley as well, cross country and track. I always knew that I wanted to be a doctor. Like, it's such a cliche to say so, but I had always had this idea. I think, you know, from, I mean, like everyone our age, I think I watched ER when I was a kid and I was like, yep, I'm going to do that. You know, I remember reading a lot of books about doctor novels and then later nonfiction and being really interested in it. I would say I was less studious. I mean, I was still very studious as a high school student, but also like somewhat more outgoing. But I still think, I don't know, you know, the most honest answer is I don't know where it came from. It always just seemed like what I wanted to do.
Yeah. But clearly you sort of carved your own path there because your parents were, other than being academicians, had no sort of inclination towards medicine at all. In fact, yeah, sort of the opposite end of the spectrum in many ways.
Yeah, they were always very supportive. I mean, it's funny, I guess there might be a genetic component in that my great aunt is a doctor in Italy, and she's from Southern Italy. Whereas my mom came from Southern Italy when she was in high school. And at that time, it would have been unheard of for a woman to be a doctor. And she kind of went to medical school in secret. And yeah, so she was a doctor in Southern Italy. She ran her own lab. One of her daughters is a doctor and one is like a PhD. So that was, I mean, it was very atypical, but you know, I didn't grow up with her exactly, though I always knew about her. So it's possible that her story in some sense inspired me as well.
That's really neat. Yeah. So then when you went to Harvard, obviously sort of medical school followed, but where does orthopedics fit in? Because again, not sort of a traditional path, in a lot of ways, and you didn't have somebody, you know, there's so many people like we were just talking about my daughter who wants to go into orthopedics, but obviously has a role model there, but like orthopedics, as we'll talk about later, isn't sort of a typical thing that a lot of women go into. And so how did you find that?
You know, again, it was also sort of a circuitous path. I think I always knew that I wanted to be a surgeon. And I think when I think back or look back on anatomy, I realize how much I was most interested in the musculoskeletal dissections and how those were always my favorite, as opposed to, let's say, you know, the abdominal dissections or something as would be expected for a general surgeon. And I think, you know, I had actually, again, probably like most women, perhaps I, certainly at the time when I went to medical school, I don't know if there were any women orthopedists that I knew at Harvard. It kind of took me by surprise how much I liked it. You know, I had sort of thought, well, you know, maybe I'll do general surgery and then subspecialize from there. And then I did, at Harvard at that time, ortho was part of your regular, just your third year surgical rotation. I was like, wow, I really like doing this. And the residents there were very supportive. They were like, you got to do it. This seems like it's right for you. And so then I had a research year. So I had a Howard Hughes medical, like a med student fellowship. And I did research that was totally not related to orthopedics. It was immunology research. But I sort of took that year to think about what I wanted to do and to, you know, to talk to people and do some shadowing and like read and all those sorts of things. And it became pretty apparent that orthopedics was what I wanted to do. And I will say one thing that I noticed about orthopedics is that at that time, if you talked to older surgeons who weren't in ortho, a lot of them were so negative about the direction of medicine, what things had become, what it was like to be a surgeon. But all the orthopedic surgeons I knew. Admittedly, I think at that time they were still all men, but they all seemed to love what they did. They all looked back so fondly in their career, and they were all so encouraging. There was none of this like, you don't want to go into medicine. It's not what it used to be. Everyone seemed to love it and seemed to have so much love still for how orthopedics was changing and growing and evolving. And I would say also that not a single one of those older male orthopedists that I knew at Harvard was in any way discouraging to a young woman.
That's awesome.
So, yeah.
I feel like that's still something that you hear so much, whether it be at IPOS or, you know, during interviews, is how I think residents or even medical students, because we, you know, do that, have them as well, just see orthopedics as this home for happy surgeons, where people can go to work every day and be pleased with the work and that they're doing, and I think that the care for patients is great because of that. And I think that there's not a lot of concern or disillusionment about medicine as a whole amongst orthopedics. So I'm glad you could pick that up early on.
Yeah, I would say it was really important for me.
Did you have then, because you mentioned that there weren't any sort of female mentors, were there any people who you looked to as being real sort of lights along that road as you were going into orthopedics early on, who sort of got you started?
I mean, I think there was a joint surgeon at Mass General, Dr. Burke, again, not a woman, a man, but he was so kind and encouraging. And I really enjoyed working with him. I think he was pretty influential to me. And I would say also, I knew Colleen Sabatini when she was a resident and I was a student, and she was great at that time as well. And then George Dwyer, he probably doesn't remember this about himself, but I rotated. He was a fourth year resident, I think, when I was a student. And he was so kind of encouraging and interesting and nice. And so I think those were some people who I met along the way who are pretty helpful. But I will say again, yeah, I did not have a female mentor in orthopedics until residency, until I came across Jen Weiss, actually.
I figured it was Jen Weiss. Now, was that a big part of your decision to go out to USC? Like, did you look at her during the interview process as a potential mentee, or you just ended up out there?
No, I think, as I've said, I had spent a lot of time at Harvard, which is a phenomenal place. I mean, so it's an absolutely incredible place to be a student, both undergrad and medical school. But I think most people would say this, and most of us tell our trainees this, at some point you have to go somewhere else. And I think I was looking for a different type of training, something maybe slightly less ivory tower-ish, which is not to say that people don't get excellent training at the Harvard residency. But for me, I think I wanted to spend time just with a different mindset, because I think, I'd spent so much time at Harvard. So I wanted to go somewhere totally different, but also where I would get excellent surgical training. And, you know, USC was really that place. It's different, but it's immersive. It's very resident run. It's very trauma heavy, and it's a great way to learn. I also honestly wanted to go to California. I thought, I've never lived in California. You know, I wasn't married, didn't have children. My parents were going to Italy. I was like, this is a great time to go somewhere new that I've always been interested in. And I will say, I mean, I loved living in California, so it was a great experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And out there, so Jen was part of the PEDS program. Who mm-hmm. else was sort of within PEDS who helped guide you towards that?
Dee Dee was there, and Nina Lightdale, all great. And then, of course, in terms of, you know, non-female mentors, Bob Kay was my formal residency mentor, but also, you know, just a huge influence on me. And how he, his sort of approach to patients, how he cares for everyone was really incredible. Everyone out there at CHLA at that time was amazing. I worked with Dave Skaggs, who was pretty nice to me for someone who was not going into spine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was going to ask about that. So you ended up going back to CHOP for general fellowship, but sports was already sort of in your mind as sort of what your ultimate career, because we both, I mean, we're same vintage, and I feel like that level of subspecialization was out there, but was not as commonplace. Like most of the people of our ilk came out as general fellows and then subspecialized from there. But you had a desire to sort of pursue PED sports from the get-go?
I think so. I mean, and it was really solidified just by how great the PED sports exposure was at CHOP. You know, I mean, of course, Ted Yanley has been such a huge influence on me, as well as Todd and Larry, who were both incredible at that time as well. And I think it was a little bit in my mind. I mean, I enjoyed doing deformity. I really liked working with Woody, full disclosure, with him on hip. Again, not a spine surgeon. Yeah. But the sport, yeah, I really enjoyed the sports. I mean, I think like all of orthopedics, you know, it changes and evolves so quickly. I really like working with athletes, you know, as a lifelong runner, I enjoy seeing what teenage athletes are up to. They're a really interesting and satisfying group of patients to work with, I think.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you know, it's funny because, again, same sort of generation. CHOP, I think, was at a point, because I was 2010. And were you like 2012, 2011?
Yeah, 2012.
Yeah. So same sort of spot where CHOP was almost going through a change as Dorman's went into Flynn from a leadership standpoint, mm-hmm. that the fellowship was growing and changing a little bit of its of the ethos of it from what I can tell. What was it about CHOP that sort of enticed you there? Other than obviously Ted, it was there. I mean, they had a big sports side, but there, you know, you could have gone to Boston. There are a lot of places to go for that. What sort of drove you to pursue CHOP?
Frankly, I'd heard great things about it. You know, I think Dave Skaggs and Jack Flynn are good friends. And so, you know, I think Skaggs really encouraged me to look hard at CHOP because it's such a great place. I think all of the PEDS fellowships are great. I think one thing that did, I mean, sports being a big part of it was appealing to me. I think getting to kind of carve your own path as you do at CHOP was also really appealing, you know, that you get to spend a lot of time on the stuff you want to do, that it's a little less structured maybe than some other fellowships. I was so impressed with the faculty when I visited. I mean, it's just I had such a great experience in fellowship. You know, I think it's my favorite educational year probably, you know, and I think my two co-fellows remain two of my closest friends. So it was great. I mean, no regrets. Absolutely. I always tell all our PD interested people that they should really think hard about CHOP.
I mean, it's such a great program. And yeah. But it's interesting that you bring that up. So I was in Dallas and we were hyper structured, right? So two months, you know, you didn't deviate that. And that was sort of, you know, I feel like CHOP was much less structured, and Rady had that side of things where like you were on call alone and had to sort of fit. So every program had like their own little nuances to it. What did you really enjoy, the sort of less structured, choose your own adventure approach? Yeah. Was that something that you were looking for?
I did enjoy that. I mean, I would say coming from USC, I did not feel like I needed that much more experience being on call by myself, because they're basically as trauma chief, like you're making a lot of decisions on your, you know? And so I felt like I had that part down. I think I would say I was looking for someplace that was highly academic, and that did give me a little more choice. I mean, I think again, coming from USC, our operative experience is so good. And particularly I got to be at CHLA every year, except my intern year. And so I felt like perhaps this is arrogance on my part, but I also felt like I kind of had the PD basics down at that point. You know, we've pinned so many elbows, done all that kind of stuff, that I felt like I was ready to exert some choice in, yeah. what I was doing. I mean, I think I would have had a good experience anywhere that I went, but I think, you know, for fellowship too, sometimes you just get to a place and you're like, this is the place for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's how it was for me in Dallas. And I think that's, I tell fellows that, well, I tell them two things. One that you alluded to earlier, like there are no bad programs. Wherever you go is going to be awesome. Okay. You're never going to know anything otherwise. But I do think that there's typically just one program that speaks to you the loudest. So it sounds like CHOP was for you, and obviously great friends there. And it's such a great spot. So you came out of fellowship as just PEDS solo trained with the idea that you're going to go into sports. And then am I correct that you started practice in Philadelphia?
Yeah, I was at the Philly Shrine for almost 10 years.
Yeah, that's what. And so tell me a little bit about that, because that is, you know, it's like building a sports practice at a Shriners hospital. And what was it, just you really enjoyed the city and you wanted to be close? Sort of take me through that side of things.
Sure. I mean, I think so for the Shrine, I think in these last decade or two, they have been interested in expanding what they do more. And I think, you know, as most pediatric programs have realized, I think it's hard to have a fully fleshed out pediatric orthopedic program that doesn't have sports medicine. Now it's so much a part of what everybody does. So I think they were looking for someone who could build a program there. I think for me at that time also, you know, I didn't necessarily want to just do sports. You know, I think I wanted to do sports, but also have the opportunity to do some other things at the same time, which the Shrine is full of other things to do, of course. I have to say, even though now I don't work there anymore, but the mission of the Shrine is so appealing. You know, we talked a little bit before about how medicine is changing, and in some, you know, many ways it is. But at the Shrine, you still get to treat everyone the same. There's so few places that are still like that. Yeah. And I think the opportunity to get to care for kids from abroad, you know, who are brought with often devastating injuries or conditions, being able to treat them the same way you would as anyone else here with excellent insurance, even if they have no insurance where they're coming from. I think that's really powerful. It's a nice way to practice. I would say also, just the leadership team there. So Scott and Amr, they were so supportive of a new person. They gave me a lot of free rein to build a program in the way that I wanted. And I don't know that every place is going to be so easygoing and open-minded and supportive of someone who's totally brand new. So they were a great duo to work for. And particularly as a new attending, I think the Shrine is a really supportive and caring place to work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm very good friends with Amr, and Scott's been on the podcast before, and he's just an incredible guy. So, I mean, two really tremendous mentors. I'm curious, because I there's so much that goes into starting a new practice, and I have some more follow-up questions about that in a minute. But one of the things that is amazing is, like, so you walk out of fellowship and you're then expected to build and grow within a pretty well-established system. It's not like you're going to a small hospital on the coast and they're like, hey, we need somebody. Can you also do sports? Like, this, the Philly Shrine in particular is probably one of the best established shrines out there. And to come straight out of fellowship to build a program, what were some of the things that you learned? How hard is it to build a program, especially early on in your practice?
I mean, I guess the short answer is it's hard.
Yeah.
But some things you can think about, I guess, are like, well, what do I bring that other people maybe don't have? And one thing, funnily enough, that I brought is being a woman with an interest in women's sports. So part of the programs that I started were female athlete programs. And one thing that teenage girls seem to find nice in a sports program is to be able to talk to a female practitioner, because sometimes some of the problems that female athletes have might be delicate to talk about, particularly if you're talking about menstrual health or psychological things. And so, you know, I was almost accidentally able to leverage my relative uniqueness to build a program in a way that maybe other people wouldn't have been able to. The other thing I would say about the Shrine is that, you know, as I'm sure you know, it has an extraordinary gait lab system, and we are just really starting to embrace motion analysis in sports medicine. Of course, CHLA has been one of the labs that's on the forefront of that, but the Shrine is really doing a lot in that space. And so that was something else that we had that maybe other places don't have. And the way that the Shrine works, again, because it has the freedom to explore what it's interested in without necessarily being so constrained by insurance, was that I was able to really do a lot with motion analysis and sports medicine. And I should really credit the motion analysis teams in both Philadelphia and Erie for being so willing to take on a completely new project and topic with me. And I mean, I learned so much from them, but they really helped drive that programmatic growth, because we could do so much in the gait lab for sports. And that was something we could offer that a lot of places couldn't.
Yeah. We're going to get into in a little bit your current role at Yale, but I'm curious, any big, like, visible lessons learned that you were able to bring from that time in Shrine at the Shrine to when you started your position at Yale?
I think you have to be patient. And I would say anyone who knows me well could tell you that patience is not one of my qualities. So you have to be patient. I mean, you know, you have to wait to see, will people come? What do they need? What will they like? What will work and what won't work? Yeah, I think it taught me to be patient. I mean, I think one thing that my time at the Shrine really impressed upon me, and this is something that I very much learned from Scott Kozin, who knows Scott knows the name of every single person who works in the Shrine. There is no employee who works there that he doesn't know something about, doesn't think about, and doesn't care about their well-being. And I think a hospital, just like a program, is built on the backs of all the people who support it. So, I mean, for a sports med program, you have to have nursing, you have to have either PTs or an athletic trainer. There's all the people who make the gait lab run. You might have non-operative sports. You need a nutritionist or a dietitian. I mean, you need a nurse who is going to be able to run your program. All those things, I mean, you might come in with big ideas and knowledge, but you're not going to get anything done without a huge team. PAs or NPs, I mean, all sorts of people. And I think from the Shrine had some amazing physical therapists, nurses, people from the gait lab who had been there a long time and who really knew how the Shrine ran and who taught me a lot about how to talk to people, how to think about athletes, how to work within the Shrine system. I mean, I think one thing that being able to work so closely with a diverse group of people taught me is that there's so much that we don't know. I mean, in sports medicine, I don't know. There's a lot I don't know about rehab, so much I don't know about rehab, about how they think through getting an athlete from surgery to being ready to play. I mean, in particular, how you rehab a thrower is totally different from anything else. And so one thing that a place like the Shrine does is teach you how important the knowledge that your multidisciplinary team really has, and how that, you know, you may think that like, I'm doing the surgery, I'm the big dog, I'm the surgeon, but like, that's a very small part of what happens. You know, like your practice is going to fall apart if you don't have like a great ATC or nurse coordinator to keep on top of things for you, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I always find it interesting when patients are like, can you write down the exercises that I need to do? And I'm like, yeah. No, like I can't even start. Like, that's why we have people in the community, and it's harder. You know, I'm sure you're the same way in your role, where you send people into smaller townships or smaller communities, and you're like, you know, you can only go so far, but having knowledgeable people to help educate the families is so critical and so helpful.
It's so important. I mean, I think we are, you know, I like, and both at the Shrine and here at Yale, I've been like so fortunate to have a really great team around me. And I think that has made my life and my practice immeasurably easier, and also just my patient care so much better.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to talk about Ruth Jackson a little bit later, but as I was preparing for this, I actually read your presidential speech from Ruth Jackson, and I loved it because it was about perfectionism. And your pedigree, right, Brearley, Harvard, USC Chop, it speaks to the fact that you probably, like my daughter, who we were talking about beforehand, have a bit of perfectionism too. And you have to be, I think, to be a good surgeon.
Yeah.
But it's also tough as you go from fellowship where you're under the tutelage of Ted or Jack or Woody or whoever, and then you have to transition to it. Can you talk about that transition and sort of the difficulties of being a perfectionist when you get into the actual practice where everything doesn't go perfectly, at least not for me?
Yeah. No, and it didn't for me. I mean, it certainly does not. I mean, I think it's terrifying. And I think one thing is that, you know, you don't know how little you know until you really start working. I mean, I think now I feel like every day I'm like, man, I really don't know anything.
True.
You know, and because I think one thing is that skilled teachers in fellowship, they will make you feel like you're doing the whole case, but like, you're not. You didn't design that tray. You didn't work with the OR staff for 10 years leading up to that moment to teach them to know exactly what to hand you when you need it, right? You didn't figure out exactly how to position this patient, all those things. And so when you're standing there and you're like, wait, what was in that tray? Did I build this right? And like, how come I don't have the probe I need? And like, why is this traction not working right? And all those tiny little things that, you know, Ted or Todd or Larry were the setup, or that, you know, that their nurse first assist that they'd worked with for 10 years would set up, and now you don't have that person. You're like, oh my God, so little of that was me. Yeah. Now I have to do it. I mean, it's hard. You have to let those things go. Surgeons all have big egos, me as much as anyone else. And I think the first 2 years in practice is just grappling with humility.
That's and learning. Great way to learn. Right?
Yeah. And you just have to. But the only way to get better is to stare those things in the face, right? You really have to look at it and say, you know, I didn't do that very well. that took too long. I was indelicate with how I took that graft, or, you know, I didn't put those portals exactly right. Like, I didn't adjust my portals right when I thought about where this meniscus tear was, or the, you know, and especially now you have to teach trainees. There's not that big, you know, end day of fellowship, someone is still helping you. The next day you might have to teach like a third year resident how to tie those knots. And so, I mean, I think you have to learn to be humble, and you're right. Like that, my pedigree didn't do a great job of teaching me to be humble. Although I would say, I mean, I think being an intern at USC is pretty humbling.
Yep.
But it is something, I mean, it is something you just have to work at. I think I'm better at it. I would say, I think I've adopted habits. I mean, I meditate and I didn't used to. I think that's helpful. I think you can be disciplined while trying to let go of perfectionism at the same time. Like, I think not being a perfectionist isn't, or trying not to be a perfectionist is not about accepting being sloppy. It's about understanding that no one is perfect and like really grappling with your flaws and trying to make them better. I think if you just coast, then you're not going to get any better at what you do, which is right. The goal is all of us want to be the best possible surgeon we can be. And you can't do that if you can't face your flaws.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's important to give yourself some grace, but to fail forward sort of whenever you can and constantly be revisiting it. And I mean, it sounds like you're just like me. I mean, 14 years in, I'm constantly reassessing, you know, giving myself a follow-up on how that case went, or even just seeing things in clinic and being like, wow, I totally could have managed that better. And I wish I'd done it. It is such a lifelong learning process.
I think that's right. I mean, I do think that that is, though, sometimes one of the joys of having trainees. You know, a really smart senior resident is someone who you can absolutely review the case with. I mean, you can just sit down and say, you know, hey, it obviously this didn't, like, some things didn't go well. Let's talk it through. And I think sometimes their insights are just as helpful as yours, because you might be stuck in a rut. You might have tunnel vision about something you're doing, and someone younger, but someone who's committed and motivated, they may sometimes through their questions, I think I learn as much as at any other time.
Yeah. Along the same lines of learning, obviously you came from the Shrine and are now in this chief position at Yale, which you and I, again, same vintage. It's a huge honor. It's a big responsibility early in your career, where I feel like, I'd like to say I'm still early in my career, even though I'm 14 years in. I don't know what I'm going to say. I'm late in my career, but you know, it's a big responsibility. And was this something that you had always sort of shot for, that just sort of came out of the blue? And you know, there's a big transition, obviously, that has to happen, where you're going essentially full-time clinical care, and all of a sudden now you're responsible for meetings and budgets and things like that. How did you like that?
Well, I guess I would say I'm still learning how to do it. I think there's a huge learning curve to being chief. And Yale is a very different institution than the Shrine also. So, I mean, part of it, there's both, I think, pluses and minuses to arriving somewhere, having been hired as the chief. I mean, obviously, you know, almost nothing about the institution, at least nothing true, right? Like you may know a lot of external things about its excellence. I mean, its research, all those things, but you don't really know until you're working there. But on the other hand, it does mean that people here know you only as the chief. They don't have to understand you in a new role, which I think can be very helpful, and perhaps self-consciously extra helpful as a woman, that, you know, you come in already with authority given to you by your title. But I would say it's been very difficult. It's been very difficult. I mean, I have a supportive chair. Lisa Latanza has been awesome, which has been really helpful. You know, I think I do have a circle of mentors that I can call when I say, hey, you know, I need to better understand how to deal with this particular problem. Jen Weiss obviously has been a huge mentor for me. I would say Marty Herman also remains an extraordinary mentor, and someone who I definitely have called at all hours to say, I really need your help working through this problem. I do think, you know, at this point, I think we've done some amount of leadership training. You know, I'm doing the Posner Leadership Program, which has been incredibly helpful. And then Yale also does provide some teaching and coaching, which has been helpful. But I guess this is a long-winded way to say there's no easy way to do it. And I think you have to approach it with the same humility that you do with learning anything else new. One thing that has made it easy for me is that I think my partners here have all been really welcoming. Adrian Sochi and I had weekly meetings in the 3 months before I started, when we would just pick a different topic each meeting and she would talk to me about, here's how things have been going here, here's what I think we need to do. And that was incredibly helpful.
That's terrific. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know Dom pretty well. And I mean, you guys have a great group.
We've got a great group. And that part, that has made much of my job much easier.
And you walked into a lot of that, which was nice that you had people who were established there. What about the side of medicine that is sort of new to you, right? Like you're still at the point where you're like, okay, I can do this. I can do my clinical care well, and that you're still learning. And now it's a totally different side of things that you really have to get good at. And to some extent, Mike Lotzbecker and I are same year, and we've talked a lot about this with this transition to Cleveland. Like you have to give up some of those skills that you were working on, I don't know what to call it, perfecting, but improving, and you finally got to a point of comfort. And then it's like, okay, whole new skill set, and also cut down half of your clinical time so you can run this department.
Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest thing is, learning how to talk to a totally new group of people. Learning how to talk to administrators, learning how to talk to the heads of nursing or ICU or whatever. And it's totally different. I mean, learning that, I don't have an MBA. So I don't know that business language as well as someone who had been to business school. And so learning how to understand their priorities, I think has been a new thing. I mean, again, just learning a new institution, right? The institutional politics of Yale are very different from those at the Shrine, which is not to say either is better or worse. Every institution has politics, but the Shrine is a very specific and unusual organization, and as opposed to like a big Ivy League university with a complicated hospital system attached to it. So those things, yeah, just understanding the politics here has been acquiring a new skill set. And I think, one thing too is that you're right. By the time we get to, let's say mid-career, because I think we have to admit that we're mid-career, you're mostly in charge of your space, right? When you're in the OR, you're in charge of your space. When you're in clinic, you're in charge of your space. But now as chief, I mean, I'm not the CEO of the hospital. So, there's a lot of times where I am not in charge of my space, where I'm at best collaborating or otherwise just answering to a totally new group of people. And like learning how to do that gracefully has been very different. And also, I would say, quite humbling.
Yeah, I can imagine. Any like big decisions or challenges that you faced as chief that like sort of stick out that you can talk about?
I would say this might be something that's specific to Yale, but the most complicated thing for me, because we are kind of a hospital within a hospital, but then also within a university. And so is learning who I answer to for different things. On the university side, I answer to the chair of my department, who is Lisa Latanza, but on the hospital side, technically, I think I answer to the chief of surgery, who is not Dr. Latanza. And then there's also, of course, the administrative side. So just figuring out who I'm supposed to tell when I'm doing something or ask for something I need can be complicated. We are in the process of hiring someone. So I've never run a search committee for a surgeon before. Of course, I've hired people clinically before at the Shrine, but this is my first time hiring, an academic surgeon, which is that is a complicated process as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so interesting. I bet a lot of the listeners either are in or will be in a similar situation, because that's what we are, right? So, there are freestanding children's hospitals that have their own academic program, but like, CHLA is rolled into an academic program. I'm my professorship is through Emory, but I'm at Children's and I have two chairs. And so I think it's a struggle. It's challenging. And there's a lot of politics that go on behind that, at least at my level of in the hierarchy, I'm definitely not privy to, but even some of my administrative chiefs aren't privy to it. It goes even beyond them. So definitely challenging. I'm curious, do you, and I'm not asking you to commit to this, but do you want to become a chair? In other words, like the next step up from where you are right now would be to become a chair someplace, which is an even higher level of responsibility on the administrative side, but may impact your clinical side of things. Do you think the chief is a good spot for you? I guess I'm asking, like, do you see this as something that really you've taken a hold of and that you could improve on or grow even more into?
I mean, yes, definitely. That it's something I don't think I've reached my maximum potential as a chief yet. I think there's a lot still for me to learn and do. I mean, that being said, you know, I guess I still have a lot of years left. Would I one day want to be the chair? Maybe. I wouldn't say no, but I guess I wouldn't say necessarily for sure. I mean, it's such a difficult job. Yeah. You know, I mean, it requires extraordinary kind of planning, composure, acumen, all those things. And I think, I mean, I certainly, I don't know, ask me again in 10 years.
Yeah. Well, I also feel like for, you know, like we both have kids, and it's tough when you've got kids, because I feel like the further you get as a clinician leader, the more somebody else's time runs your daily life. I love what I do right now because I know, like, I'm in the OR, I have these meetings. Outside of that, like, I can structure around and see my daughter's lacrosse game or go to my son's tennis match or whatever. And that I think is really nice. But I feel as though the more administrative roles I take on, the more I have to coordinate with, you know, the either hospital leadership or the GI division or whatever to have meetings outside of hours. And so I feel like the more you get into the leadership role, the less your own time you're on.
100%. I really agree with that. And I think that is always a consideration. I mean, certainly for me, when I think about taking on additional kind of national committee work, that's something I think about too. You know, how much, I mean, in part, I think you want to think about, like, right now, for example, as RJOS president, I really want to be able to focus on that. But there are some programs, for example, that require a lot of weekend work. And I think for now, you know, I really try to protect a lot of my weekend time just to spend with my daughter or to do things as a family. I mean, obviously, I take call like anyone else, but. What's that?
And podcasts.
Yeah, exactly. But in general, I'm hesitant to take things that, you know, of course, the occasional meeting, right? I love going to national meetings like POSNA, which does sometimes include a weekend, but I don't want to routinely agree to do something that's every other Saturday, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about RJOS because that was obviously, I think, you know, something that I thought was unique and that you would have a great perspective on. So I have to admit, I knew about it sort of peripherally and more generally, but I did a little bit of background and it's super cool. And I didn't realize who Ruth Jackson was. Can we hear it from you a little bit on some of the background of who she was and how your involvement started and with them prior to your presidency?
Sure. So she was the first board certified female orthopedic surgeon and the first woman to be a full member of the AAOS. And those things were difficult for her. I mean, she really had to fight to attain both of those things. Ruth Jackson, as an organization named after her, is actually as old as POSNA. We are more than 40 years old. And it is a great organization. I'm glad you think so. I mean, it's a community of women and men and non-binary people whose overall goal together is to support women in orthopedic surgery for their whole career. And our goal is really to engage people as early as students, so even undergrads can be members, and then support them with things they may need throughout the entirety of their career, all the way up to senior or even retired, not least of which is a community of people, which may be a nice thing for people to have when they're the only woman in their practice, for example. We provide mentorship, of course, but also many more things, training, resources, meetings, education, grants for research, and then mentorship through all those processes. One of the things that's most notable for me is it's a great group of women. I mean, I think, you know, when I think of all the people I've met and all the great advice they've given me, and now all the people who I guess am responsible for giving great advice to, it's been great. I did the Ruth Jackson Traveling Fellowship, which had such a meaningful impact on my practice. It's really just been incredible.
Wow. I didn't see that. So tell me about that. Tell me about the Traveling Fellowship.
I mean, one of the nicest things about the fellowship is that you get to design it yourself. And so you choose a topic. For me, obviously it was sports, but then you can list the places you want to go. So I went to spend time in a couple of different places. I went to LA and I went to Boston, and I saw a variety of different practices when I was in those places. And it really helped me think about my own practice and bring back a lot of really interesting information to back to the Shrine, which is where I was at that time. But other people, of course, choose to do different things. Some people go abroad. You really have the leeway to choose what you want to do.
That's terrific. And I don't know if it's directly affiliated, but I know that there's support of it at the Perry Initiative Project and the and whatnot. Yes. Is that directly through Jackson or that? I know it's separate, but you have partnered with that as well, right?
Yes. So the Perry Initiative is a separate entity that was started by our chair at Yale, Lisa Latanza. We are of course connected because our goals are similar. And so there is a Perry representative or liaison on our board. But they're technically separate entities. Obviously, there's a huge overlap between who volunteers for Perry and who belongs to Ruth Jackson. But the Perry Initiative is an incredible program. As I'm sure your listeners know, its goal is to introduce both engineering and orthopedic surgery to girls, both in high school and as medical students. And so it's a great way to engage young women. They have data that shows that, you know, kind of the women who do this program overwhelmingly go into either ortho or engineering. I think it's also a great way to expose newer faculty or even residents and fellows to mentorship opportunities. And so our residents participate and they do a great job kind of working with and mentoring the younger students, which I think, you know, again, as women in particular, when there aren't so many of us, I think it's incumbent on all of us to kind of mentor and support the next generation. And this is a really nice way to have the residents start doing that.
Yeah, Mara Schenker, who is our chief at Grady, has been involved, and my daughter is sort of at that age where there are no current offerings in Atlanta, but I'm sure they'll come back soon. But it's one of those things that's definitely sort of on our radar, and I think really neat. We actually have a summer internship for young women in high school who they'll be with me this summer and some other people, which is
cool. Really cool.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So I just think it's great. So, you know, I wanted to ask you, we're both, you know, on the POSNA board, and one of our discussions has been around sort of the DEI space. And so I wanted to talk to you a little about that specifically as it pertained to sort of females in orthopedics. We've hired a consultant. We've had a lot of high level discussions about this topic as it pertains to our membership. And women represent approximately 30%, if I remember correctly, of our membership. And we have a relatively small percentage of underrepresented minorities, both men and women. And this is certainly better than like adult spine, where I think it's 5% or something like that. But we're certainly a ways away from true parity. Can you give me some insights as to how you feel we're doing in POSNA? And I know that you were part of, I'd read this interview in Becker's a little while back, where there were some things that were, felt could be to be related to why there are fewer orthopedic or women in orthopedics, like number of mentors and leaders and whatnot. So how do you think we're doing and where do you think the real opportunities for growth are?
I mean, I think, you know, as you've said, I think we are doing better in POSNA than really any other area in orthopedics, which doesn't mean we're doing perfectly. I think that, you know, as Christy Weber said in her speech, you can't be what you can't see, right? So I think the more of us there are, the more there will eventually be. I do think it is important that we are respectful and welcoming. You know, I think, as you mentioned, we do hear from students and residents sometimes that they're not always made to feel welcome or included, that they may have to deal with stray comments and things like that. So I think, I mean, the lowest hanging fruit is just don't do those things.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think in PD ortho, we don't do that much or as much of that. Part of what we need to do too, is we need to expose people to it early. You know, I think orthopedics is so competitive now that you may feel that if you, and as you know, for someone like me who realized somewhat late that they wanted to do orthopedics, I think a student like that might now feel like they're at an incredible disadvantage. And so I think we do have to ensure that people get exposed to it early and that ideally get exposed to it and by people who present a diverse background. And so, you know, if you see women and underrepresented minorities in your early years doing orthopedics, you may feel more ready to do it yourself or more welcomed or more able to do it yourself.
Do you feel, I think it's a great point, do you feel through, like, for example, IPOS, where you have an opportunity to interact with learners and younger folks who aren't necessarily in your practice or in your sphere, do you feel like we're still excluding, for example, women because they don't have role models or route into their specialty at their home institution? In other words, they come to IPOS and all of a sudden they're like, oh, wow, there are all these great women leaders. I just don't have that at home. And so Pete's hadn't really been on my radar.
That's a great question. I do think IPOS, particularly the focus on mentorship, can do a lot to combat that. I mean, I think it's a great question about what someone does. You know, if you work at an institution that has no female faculty, you know, do you really feel like you can do it? I think the more people travel, I mean, maybe now too, with more things being available online, they might be more exposed. Ruth Jackson does try to run webinars. I mean, I think POSNA does a good job of displaying a diverse array of people in their webinars. I think it's an open question. I mean, what more we can do? I think, as you know, part of the pipeline problem, not for women, but for underrepresented minorities, is that medical schools have not done a great job of being welcoming and inclusive of underrepresented minorities in medical school. So part of what is probably incumbent on us to do is to work even earlier, you know, and engage high school students and undergrads. I mean, it sounds like your program is doing a great job with that in terms of having high school interns. I mean, I think it starts really early. And I think we have to expose people to it really early to ensure that people know that they all have a home in ortho.
And I guess the other question that I have sort of along those lines, like, for example, when I went through medical school and went on my OB rotation, you know, they have sort of the opposite spectrum of the problem, right? So like, there are very few male obstetricians and gynecologists, at least at Vanderbilt, there were none on from a residency standpoint, I think that I could remember. And I guess from a Ruth Jackson standpoint, or just from a, you know, personal standpoint, do you feel like parity, 50-50 is something that is that a goal? Like, do we feel like there's a lot of, are we going to be seeing an increase in applicants if we increase the visibility, or at some level is orthopedics something that may not reach that sort of 50-50? Sort of like, I don't think OB is probably ever going to get there either.
That's a really good question. I don't know the answer to it. I think, you know, most people say that 30% is what you need for people to have a voice, for people to feel welcome, for people to be included, and to have a culture change. I don't know that we have to ever be 50-50. You know, I think there are reasons why men perhaps don't go into OBGYN. I don't think those necessarily pertain in the same way, in that, you know, you're not dealing with exclusively male anatomy in orthopedics. Other than OBGYN, I don't know what the parity numbers are like for other surgical fields.
Like urology.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know that information. I mean, I think, I don't know that 50% has to be the goal. I mean, that feels far in the future. I think, you know, 30% in all of orthopedics is a great goal. And I mean, like, we can't carry all that weight in POSNA too. We'd have to all be women, right? To filter out. I mean, I think it would be nice, you know, I think there are other fields, you know, hand surgery comes to mind as well, that has better gender parity than some of the other fields. Again, I don't think 50% has to be the goal necessarily, but I think the goal should be that anyone who wants to should feel welcome, and that people don't feel like they're carrying an extra burden, an extra diversity burden, and that they're able to just do their job the same way that anyone else would do their job, and not have it always affect, kind of be in their mind or affect their career goals.
Absolutely. And so sort of stepping it up to the next level, one of the goals I know within Ruth Jackson is to promote leadership positions in ortho. Mm-hmm. At our positive leadership level, we've seen an increase, right, in this on the board. So, like, you know, you, Christine, Selena, Jen Lane, Jen Bauer, Jason, as well. How do you feel like we are doing in this realm of diversification and inclusion within the positive leadership, again, sort of at the board level?
I think we're doing much better. I think you can see my recent boards have been much more diverse. I think I will caveat that by saying that obviously we've only ever had one woman president. We've never had a Black president. We've never had a Latino or Latina president. You know, and I think I will give you two separate answers to that question. As a woman, you know, and as an advocate for women, you know, of course I would like to see another woman president. I would love to see an underrepresented minority president. And I think, you know, sometimes for the younger women, it can feel hard to say, you know, there's 30% of us are in POSNA. Like, why don't we have more leadership, female leadership at the absolute top? I think from a board perspective, and again, I will just say, you know, patience is not my strong suit, but it takes, you know, from a board perspective, I think the answer is it takes time. People have to attain the seniority. People have to climb the ranks. People have to, you know, you can't just come out of fellowship and be president of POSNA. Like, there's a lot of things you have to do to get there. And so I think those things, I guess when I think about how I think about Posna. Those two things are always in tension within myself, to know that, you know, what I would say is that I don't think anyone wants something they haven't earned, right? No one wants to become the president of Posna because just because they're a woman. You want to earn it the same way that anyone else, that a man would earn it. And so, you know, again, I think those things are complicated. I do think that we're doing better. And I think, you know, every year, I think things get better. And I do think one thing I would say is that I think the board and the senior leadership at Posna is very aware of it. And I think they grapple with this question all the time, too. I don't think it's a blind spot for them at all. I think it's something they're actively concerned with and working on.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I've thought about, and I've, you know, Lori was a great mentor to me, but I remember she was such a family person, right? And this goes back to what we were talking about earlier. You know, she had three girls, and one of them was at Emory when I was just starting out here. And as she got sort of into that leadership line, I know it became harder and harder to have those relationships with family. You look at Dan right now, right? And he's got a senior and a couple of kids in college, and it's a unpaid volunteer position that takes like 60% of your time. And so to figure out how to put that into your life is challenging for anybody as well. And I totally agree. I mean, that's why I'm so impressed about you as a chief at a relatively young portion of your career. Like, you, there's a lot of balance that goes into that. But, you know, if you take that, you're probably, you know, if I were to say, okay, you're going to be the president next year, you're like, whoa, I got a lot going on. It's a tremendous responsibility from a time standpoint as well. So I agree. I mean, I asked all of this to get your perspective, but I agree with everything you said. I think it is not a blind spot for us. I think we've been thinking about it a lot and making improvements. But there are so many talented females, especially sort of mid-career and below, who are going to be coming up and along. It's going to be, you know, we're going to have a wealth of resources from that standpoint not too long from now.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, there are a number of incredible women who I'm sure we'll see there someday soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me talk to you a little bit about work-life balance, because we were alluding to that a second ago. And you got a daughter who's six. And, I'm not good at this. I try to get better. And I was telling you before that Min Coker, when he was on, is like, there's no such thing as work-life balance. But how do you balance, to whatever extent you can, the rigors of parenting with being a leader, a researcher, and obviously a clinician?
I mean, I think Min is exactly right. I think the first thing you have to accept is that there is no balance. I think what I try to do, and I think, you know, my husband is also a surgeon, so I think it gets complicated in our house. I do think we carve out some particular times. And so I do try my utmost to not have anything regularly scheduled during immediately after school and dinner. So kind of between 5:30 to 7:15, you know, that's sort of protected time. And that does mean that, you know, I can see her when she gets home from school, and sometimes I can pick her up from school and we can hang out a little bit. And then we do really try hard to all have dinner together as a family. And then we do sometimes have, there are some weekend activities that we do together. And so my husband and I, to some extent, take turns with those. So we each have some amount of time with her doing the things we love. And then I guess I would say part of the solution too is just there's less time for other stuff. And so, you know, I do go do things in the evening. I like to run, but I do that early in the morning before anyone else is up. And so I hesitate to say that the answer is just sleep less, but it's entirely possible that that is just the answer. And I think you have to figure out what's not important and then let those things go. I mean, one thing that I have found is that now that we're out of the fog of sort of babyhood and toddlerhood, now she is interested in activities that I also enjoy doing. So, you know, I feel like when she was little, certainly in the early days of your career, you just don't have any hobbies, right? You're like, I don't have time for anything. Like, maybe I can exercise, but I can't do anything else because I just, either I'm working or I'm researching or my kid's little, and like, not, you know, all those things. But now at six, she's interested in a lot of cool stuff. We go horseback riding together, which is great. You know, we play games. She plays chess, which has been so fun. Like, well, she wants to go running. We'll go running outside. It's awesome. So I feel like we're entering a phase when I can pick things up because she likes them that are also kind of interesting and mentally relaxing to me. So I guess I would say I feel more balanced than when she was an infant.
Yeah.
When, you know, when things, I mean, I guess there's no way, you know, it's just difficult. Being pregnant as a surgeon is difficult. Trying to find time to pump, you know, when, during a busy day is very difficult. Now that we're out of that, I think things feel close, not balanced, but less out of balance, I guess I would say.
Yeah. I mean, depending a little bit on sort of how the activities go over the next like 6 or 7 years, we really came into it when my daughter started playing a lot of lacrosse, and you just realize that like it's super fun when she wanted to throw the lacrosse stick in the backyard or throw the lacrosse ball in the backyard with me. And it becomes a whole different animal when she's like on a travel team and having to fly up to Baltimore and stuff like that and take time. But it does get a whole lot easier from that standpoint. But one of the things I wanted to come back to, and I think Min was the other one who talked about this, and I'm just sort of curious how you structure it, this idea that you like don't schedule things from 5:15 to 7:30. And I'm wondering, like, how do you go about doing that? Do you just say, sorry, that's sort of that's out of bounds time, and we're not going to do that, or how do you make that work for you in real time?
I mean, I guess I would say, yes, that's what I say. You know, I say, I really try hard to protect family time. I have the benefit, I think, in our section, everyone has kids, and everyone has kids at home. Dom's kids are the oldest, but they're still at home. And, you know, he's very involved with them. And so I think it's something that everyone actually in pediortho at Yale really appreciates, because we all want to have dinner. Everyone is pretty family oriented. Everyone wants to have dinner with their kids. And so that makes it really easy, because nobody in our section wants to have a meeting at 6 p.m. So that makes it work. The other thing I would say is that my administrative assistant is awesome, and she knows to protect my time in that way. And so, for example, on Wednesday mornings, I have some admin time, and I try to take Ray to school on those mornings. And so my secretary really aggressively protects like 7:30 to 8:30 on Wednesday mornings. And she will not put anything on there unless asking me specifically. And she'll really only ask if our chair is asking. You know, she'll say, Dr. Latanza can only meet with you at this time. Can we do it then? But otherwise she just says, no, she's not available at that time.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of people who can make your life better, you know, a good administrative assistant will make everything in your whole world better. And I think she knows that specific family time is important to me, and she really protects it very aggressively, which has been amazing.
Yeah, we actually just lost ours, who was amazing, and then we coerced her and spammed her with text to the point that she just agreed to come back, which I'm super excited about, because she's amazing.
Amazing. I mean, it makes such a difference to your world. I mean, I think, you know, if you say I'm not available at 6, but I can meet you at 8, I think it's really clear to people you're not just like faffing off at 5:15 when work is done, right? You're like, I'm available between 8 and 10 p.m. pretty routinely, but I'm just not available at dinner time. I think then people will, you know, I don't think it comes across as laziness. I think it comes across as, you know, this is something important to me, and then, you know, you can have my time later on.
That's a really good way to look at it. I'm glad you said that. I mean, I think that it is easy for people to be like, oh, they can't meet me when I'm available. But the reality is, if you can meet later, then like you said, it's not that you're saying their time's not important. It's just that you've got something that's really critical there, and that you guys have to work together and compromise.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think it does help. I mean, I think Lisa has really deliberately put together a pretty diverse department. There's a lot of people with kids. It's a very racially diverse department as well. There's a lot of women in leadership positions here. And so I mean, you don't want it to be on the responsibility of women to make things more family friendly, but I think that's just de facto sometimes how things go. And the fact that there's so many women in leadership here, I think does mean that there is more of an understanding about family time being important.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me ask you this again. I mentioned earlier sort of the type A personality, and I'm one as well. So how do you, and you talked about meditating, you talked about running, so I'm guessing those are a couple of the answers, but how do you prevent yourself with a lot of these balls in the air from reverting back to sort of that type A state where you just put your head down and you work at the expense of either your mental well-being or your family or whatever?
I mean, I think those, you've said it exactly right. I mean, meditating and running are the two big things. I mean, I think when you've been running for a long time, I think running becomes a sort of meditation. You know, I run some kind of workout, I'm almost always running, almost every day. And I think if I know I'm going to have a difficult OR day, I meditate and then I run. And then I, you know, the day just goes better. It like resets my mind. I think especially if you can kind of let things clear out while you're running, it just helps you reset. I also think honestly that the discipline that comes from running, assuages a little bit of the perfectionism, and then also kind of spills out into being able to be disciplined in other areas of your life. You know, I think just being able to relax and have fun with your child also sometimes can help with that. You know, kids, I mean, six is such a good age. She's so funny. And just being able to be goofy with her, I think, allows me to relax a little bit as well. I'm not going to say that I'm great at it. You know, I remain pretty type A, but yeah. maybe the best I can hope for is to mitigate it slightly.
Yeah. I mean, but I think that's what makes surgeons who we are. And so it's hard to sort of, you know, you can take the dog out of the fight, but not the fight of the dog kind of thing. You're always going to have that back there. And it is what makes you great, but figuring out ways to manage it are terrific. And I tried some meditating. I'm the same way with workouts, but I think that you have to find that release valve someplace, or you will either A, go crazy, or B, just sort of, you know, put your family and friends on the back burner to the extent that you lose them. So
totally.
Yeah. Finish up. So you and I are both have moderator roles in a couple of weeks at EPOS, and you're in the sports section. And I always like to try to talk to people about some specially specific stuff on this, but the reality is that I'm about as far from sports as it is. So I don't have any direct questions, but I'm curious because I spent some time recently looking at the program, and I'm on the program committee, so I was sort of part of choosing it. When you sort of look at it and think about either about certain areas that are of interest to you or certain specific abstracts, maybe if you can get that granular, that you're really looking forward to hearing about, anything that you think is really interesting and you think is going to bring a lot of discussion at the meeting in sport with regards to sports?
Oh, sure. I mean, I guess this again, sorry to beat the dead horse, but of course, anything pertaining to the female athlete is always interesting to me. I mean, I think we know there is so much difference in how boys and girls injure themselves, and how boys and girls and men and women recover from surgery, recover from injury. So that's always interesting. I mean, I think one of the nice things about sports is that it's constantly evolving. So now we're really seeing a shift to people using mostly quad tendon for adolescent ACLs. I mean, I'm interested to hear more about the bear as well. You know, that's always an interesting topic of discussion. Then, of course, patellofemoral instability is an ever-evolving topic, right? Like, there's so much we still don't know. I've recently changed somewhat how I do it. Of course, being influenced by John Fulkerson himself, who is here at Yale, who has become an incredible mentor to me, which is honestly, it's terrifying to have to do a Fulkerson in front of him. And he insists that you not call it that also, because he, for being as famous and well-known as he is, he's incredibly humble. But so seeing what's new in the world of patellofemoral instability is always really interesting. I think, frankly, because there's still so much to know, it's an area of pediatric sports medicine that's still really creative. I mean, people are trying and doing so many different things and approaching problems in different ways. I'm always excited to hear some of those controversies, you know, trochleoplasty or no, for example, or MP versus MQ-TFL, maybe to a spine surgeon. That just sounds
a lot of abstract. Yeah.
So I'm interested to hear those things and, you know, looking forward to some good discussion. You're right. I mean, I think one thing you realize that you don't know until you're up there in the glare is, you know, it is not zero work to be a good moderator. You've got, and when you see someone do it deftly, you just think, man, that's how they do it is so great. It's so skillful. You know, you have to be a little bit funny, but a little bit aggressive sometimes. And just and if it's quiet, you have to draw people out. It's such a pleasure listening to a well-moderated session. And it's so excruciating listening to a poorly moderated session.
Totally. And you don't want to fall into that latter half. Yeah.
No. I mean,
like Dennis Wenger and Jack is so good at it. I mean, just
totally,
you know, there's definitely some pressure that goes along with that. I'm curious. One of the things that I've found very interesting, again, not as a sports person, but as somebody who does some limb deformity stuff, is the collaborative efforts that seem to be going on in sort of lower extremity stuff with rotational aspects and how those can pertain to patellofemoral instability or tendon and ligamentous injuries. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that or if there's anything coming down the pipe there.
I do. I mean, so you're right. I think we're recognizing more and more how much sort of femoral antiversion and tibial torsion contribute to patellofemoral instability, particularly when they're kind of out of sync. You know, I guess miserable malalignment is the frequent term that's used. I mean, I think some things that, you know, I think about sometimes is that I think when you think about a derotational osteotomy for someone who does CP or kind of deformity surgery, that's like nothing. But to a family who's expecting to just hear, yeah, I'm going to strap this little ligament into your leg and everything's going to be fine, to hear about a derotational osteotomy can sometimes be a big lift for a sports family. So I think we're kind of, or a sports procedure, I think we're still working out in sports medicine about when you should do it and when not. You know, I think for pediatric sports medicine, if you can get a hold of a kid with a valgus knee and patellofemoral instability before they're done growing, that's, you know, it's so nice and easy to be able to correct that knee valgus with guided growth as opposed to having to do a distal femoral osteotomy. And so that, I mean, that's something that I've been thinking about a little bit more lately. And, it, you know, it's nice to have the opportunity to do that correction. I think the big question is, if you have a valgus knee, should you do a distal femoral osteotomy as part of your index procedure? And I think, you know, there are some good literature. Phil Wilson has a great series on it, but we certainly don't have anything approaching level one evidence. And so I don't think we have any conclusive information yet, but I do think it's going to be a topic of conversation for the next 5 to 10 years for sure.
And how about patellofemoral loading in maybe the non-athlete or the very recreational athlete? You know, I think this sort of falls under the, when we have families who come in and their kid has like a 1 centimeter leg length difference, and the family's like, is this ever going to cause a problem? You're like, no, but then you realize that it may. And I'm curious, because we know the patellofemoral or the patellofemoral mechanics and articulation is predicated to some extent on the rotation, there are a lot of people like you and I who, I mean, our athletic endeavors right now include running in a straight line, but the increased femoral anaversion is going to asymmetrically load that joint. Do you think that there are any roles, or when a family comes in and their kid's got a little bit of extra anaversion, but they're not super athletic, do you feel like that may have some long-term downstream effects that may not affect them as an athlete, but maybe just as like a middle-aged adult?
That's a great question. I mean, I guess the answer is, I don't know if we know. Mm-hmm. I think for someone who is not super athletic, I mean, you wonder, like, maybe can you correct a little bit of it just with really strengthening their hip? You know, really getting those external rotators to hold their, I mean, because presumably they don't have a contracture, right? So some amount of that you can achieve with physical therapy. I mean, I think while I'm on this soapbox, I will say it's amazing how even really strong athletes have kind of weak hips. You know, when you ask them to do like a heel tap off a box or, you know, doing some kind of complex maneuver, you can come cover a lot of hip weakness, even in people who are pretty strong, you know. And I think I'm going to use this time to make a plug for early strengthening in athletes. You know, I think if someone is old enough to do, you know, year-round sports, which hopefully not the same sport, but we all know how that goes. I mean, then they're old enough to do strength and conditioning, right? They don't have to be in CrossFit when they're 9, but it is good. You know, you have to be strong. Your core has to be strong. Your hips have to be strong to protect your knee, no matter what. And so I think there's some room for a little strengthening that maybe can help a little bit.
Yeah. So part of the reason I asked the question is, interestingly, my wife, who's a couple years older than me and was not an athlete growing up at all, like a year ago developed rip-roaring patellofemoral arthritis, grade 3 changes. Mm-hmm. And you know, she started playing tennis when she was 41, and now at some point may need a patellofemoral arthroplasty. And in speaking with some of my adult colleagues, they're like, we see this a fair amount in the middle age, especially females, and they feel like it may have some level of correlation to mild residual anaversion, and probably to some extent what you just mentioned, which is like, as somebody who wasn't athletic growing up, she also never worked out, didn't do year-round strengthening, and so I bet there's a lot that goes into that. But it's something that I've had an interest in, mostly because I'm living with it right now, and I've read countless abstracts over the last couple of years, and there's so much work being done on patellofemoral in general. I find it fascinating, and then I think that maybe at this year's IPOS, there's going to be some collaborative stuff with femoral rotation and how that may pertain to both upstream at the hip and then downstream at the knee.
It's a really interesting question. And I mean, I think the end result of that question is, though, when do you pull the trigger on doing a derotational osteotomy? Yeah. Which, again, that's not a small lift in anyone, right? I mean, especially if you're doing it, you know, with a nail, then you're going through their hip musculature, which is like, how great is that? And although, I don't know. Anyway, there's a lot of questions, which I'm not articulating well, but I think, you know, what we learn about it is very interesting. But the question is, like, when can you sell some, if it's a surgical solution, when do you tell someone they have to have surgery for a problem that hasn't really happened yet?
Totally. Totally. Right. It's like the Gans for a asymptomatic hip dysplasia.
Right, exactly.
You know, in Europe, they get them, they all get PAOs, and in the U.S., we wait till they're symptomatic, which may mean that they have some underlying arthritic changes at that point. So it's tough. Well, and I looked through the entire book yesterday because we were doing sort of final edits on it, and the sessions just look amazing.
I can't wait.
Really interesting too.
It's going to be a great meeting. I mean, I'm excited to be able to, you know, meet a larger group of people. I wasn't able to go to the last combined meeting in Barcelona, so I'm especially excited to see everyone at this one. I think it's going to be great.
Yeah, I think it's super cool that we were able to get, you know, a POS and an EPOS member as a moderator to have some differences there. I feel that there's a lot of diversity in terms of the research and the backgrounds of the presenters and whatnot. I think it's going to be an awesome meeting.
Can't wait. Will say, I'll give you one meeting anecdote, if I may. I ran into Vern Tolo at the coffee hour at a meeting not long ago, a couple years ago. And he was like, oh, the session's starting. Got to go back in. There's more to learn. I mean, imagine being a giant like him and still feeling like there's so much for you to learn at POSNA. I mean, I just feel like that's such a career goal for me to be in the later stages of my career. I mean, not that I could ever imagine myself a giant in the field like him, but just to still be so curious. What a gift to still be so curious at that age and stature. It was really just incredible.
Yeah, just to always be as excited as you were the first time you went.
Yeah.
It's
amazing. Super, I mean,
that's a great story.
I mean, maybe that's what makes a great surgeon, is curiosity.
Yeah. Well, I think it is. I mean, I think that sort of endless pursuit of answers, and you look at so many people who are so well accomplished, and I don't feel like they feel like they've accomplished anything about what they want, because there's always more to learn and there's always more to do.
Yeah, it's really inspiring to meet people like that.
So, well, listen, Corinne, this has been awesome. I told you it would fly by. It flew by for me.
Same here.
So easy to talk to, and this was great. And so I will look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks.
Listeners.
Hopefully this will come out beforehand. A lot of them like having something to listen to going into it. So you'll probably have a lot of people coming up to you.
Okay. Sounds great.
So, but thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.